Live. Catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
So my profile interview today, I have been discussing. So before he came into studio, when we did our throw forward with Rufila, I said, Rufila, do you know Rams? She says, Rams. I said, Rams Mabote. She says, I think I know. I said, he's just penned a book. But it's not just a book. It's a novel. Said, okay, interesting. She says, what's the title of the book? I said, Sweetest Taboo. She said, oh, is it for nighttime radio? Rams is in studio with us. Rams, thanks for coming through. Good evening.
Good evening, Pimelo. You know, firstly, I must take exception. Earlier, driving in here, flying in here.
Yes.
You spoke to Snow Tambo and you called him Mr. Tambo and you called me Rams. Not only am I older than him, but I think I also deserve to be called Mr. But it's fine. Call me Rams. It's fine. Everybody calls me Rams.
I didn't see that coming. You know, that quirk comes through a lot, though, in your podcast. You must love it, don't you?
I'm having a good time.
You must
love it. I won't lie. Yeah. I'm having a bloody good time. Yeah. I'm off the kind of stuff you guys do, the heavy stuff.
And how do they feel about you almost taking the mickey out of them in a way? Because I think they take themselves quite seriously.
They do. Yeah. And that's why they never come to my show.
I've had a few of them, but those who were
not too serious, but they ran away from me. I mean, I literally just bumped into Panyaza. I can't tell you how many times I've invited him. Yeah. And he's promised, but
never showed up.
But he makes a lot of content for me. That's good.
Why do you think that was important for you to reflect on a country like the one we have right now at a time like this, and perhaps show us another side of the politics?
I just thought it was missing. Mm. You know, I looked around the world. It's been done for many, many years around the world, and we're not doing it here. Mm. In fact, you know, the one person who used to do this. It's Peter Der Aes.
Yes, of course.
Right? On stage. Yeah, yeah, right? I mean, he is that ambassador from Barbetico Society. I still remember, right? Yeah. He's the only guy I remember who did this. And I thought, but somebody must do this. Mm. This is out there. We can still do politics with a lot of satire, tongue in cheek, sarcasm, and fun.
Mm. Were you tired of politics?
I was. Still am. I am tired of current affairs. I did it for so many years, I got tired.
And you know, and this is not necessarily personally directed at you, but it's trying to drive a point that I can tell that you're having fun. Everything about you says you're having fun. And when we usually say, you know, when you start walking to the newsroom, when I started working in the news environment, I never drank coffee. And then I had to have a vice. Coffee became my vice. But, you know, it gets harder. For some people, it gets to be harder stuff.
Yeah.
Because the truth of the matter is that it's heavy. It's a lot. And you carry that with you 24 hours a day. Nonstop, even when you're not working. So I can tell that you've been away from the heaviness of the news.
So I used to work for this station.
Yeah.
When it was in a modest studio in Newtown.
Yes.
And I was 9 p.m. to 10 p.m.
Yeah.
But I would be working the whole day.
Yes.
Right? Absolutely. As I wake up, I try to listen to everybody else. I try to read the paper.
Absolutely.
I never had a rest, and I was only paid for the 1 hour that I did the show for.
Tell them, Rams.
I'm free now, right? I feel so refreshed. But you know what? I think I also found myself.
Yeah.
I think in this process, I actually found myself.
Yeah.
I realized that over the years, I always make this joke with a friend of mine. We play golf together. So he says, I never knew this side of you. And I said, you know, I suspect this is what happens at school. You know, you get A grades at mathematics and science. You think, you got to be an engineer or a doctor. Mm. And you fall for that trap. Mm. So I fell for this trap all my life. Then, of course, that didn't happen. Then I went into journalism and I got into politics. I mean, I became a political editor, a journalist at a very young age and stuff like that. But it was never me. I still remember even teachers at school used to like chastise me for being this noisy, naughty, off the hook kind of guy, you know, and they were like, but you're too smart to be doing those stupid things. And I, damn, if I did the stupid things much earlier, I would be far by now.
Really?
Yes. I'd be so far in life by now.
Yeah, but as I was saying, seriously, one can tell that you are living. You know, like you are full of life.
I could even take a risk of writing that book.
We're here.
I was never going to do it if I stayed in that seat you're sitting on.
Would you have written this book while your parents were alive?
Yes, actually, I wrote this book while my parents were alive.
But they didn't see the manuscript.
They didn't. No, I mean, no, they didn't see the manuscript, and they were never going to see it.
This is the point.
They were alive. So, if they were alive now, I would have told them I wrote a book, but nothing of interest.
Nothing to worry about.
Yeah,
don't worry.
Some nonsense that. Yeah.
How long were you writing this book for?
In my head.
Mm-hmm. In your head.
For about 5 years.
Really.
Actual writing, about 6 months.
Okay.
Yeah. So once I had completed the book in my head, and I wrote it complete until the last moment, and then I opened the laptop and I started writing. Thank God for COVID. There was nothing else to do.
Oh, did you write this during COVID?
I wrote it during COVID. So all I could do was to open my laptop, eat and drink and write. That's all I did.
Were you always a novelist inside of you?
I think so. I go back to school. I go back to things I wrote. I go back to... At standard five, what is standard? What is they call it? Grade something, right?
Yeah, seven, I think, or five.
I think
or
it's
six.
Seven. Yeah. Yeah, I know it's
seven.
Two plus
seven,
or two
seven,
minus,
seven,
something
seven,
like
seven.
That. Yeah, grade seven. I was once made to stand on top of a dustbin, rubbish bin at school, to read out an essay I had written.
Hmm.
Right. So I reflect on those days, and I'm like, I actually always wrote. So I created stories. I was always a storyteller. Mm-hmm. It also happened at high school. I mean, this high school one, I even remember the topic. It was an Afrikaans essay. Gelukkig dat was a droom. Right? Luckily, it was a dream. Mm. And I still remember Mistress Marite making me read out to everybody else at school. So I've always been a storyteller.
And where did you get that from?
I think growing up in the hood, you pick up stuff. I think my dad was also a storyteller. In fact, I'm writing another book of short stories
that
my dad used to tell us.
Oh, wow.
Yes, you know, and I hope the publishers won't interfere with the name of the book, because I just want to call it Stories of Brother Prince, right?
Yes,
because
that's
who he was. Yeah. So he always told stories. This guy always had a story, and he claimed those stories were true, but I never believed a single one of them. not one of those stories.
So, I mean, I knew you can write, but this novel took me by surprise. It really did.
I told you to fasten your seatbelt.
Yeah, you did. You did, and I wasn't ready and prepared for the ride. It was quite a ride.
Pardon the pun.
Rams. It was quite a ride. Was this the only novel in you?
No, actually. So years ago, I started penning something, and I'm still married to this name, The House of the Rising Sun.
Mm-hmm.
I lived, like most of people my age, there's a point of my life I lived in Hillborough, mm-hmm. right? And in Hillborough, everything happened.
Everybody,
right?
Yeah.
And I started penning this story in my head about this funky house where so many things were happening from a vantage point of the flat I lived in.
Mm.
And that's the first book I was writing.
Mm.
But I battled with it because I had not enough material. I kept on seeing one story every time. So I did not have enough material to build on it. This one was easier for me.
Why?
Easier, and this is the only biographical part of the book.
Mm-hmm.
In
Rick,
that I traveled...
I'm listening carefully.
I traveled to Australia.
So
these towns I mentioned there, I know.
Yes.
I spent weeks in Australia, and therefore I could stretch...
Mm.
The story to a lot of things that were happening that I saw, but then I created characters and I created a damn lie. I mean, that's fiction, right? I created something that didn't exist, because everything else in that book is fiction, except for the fact for the towns I traveled.
Yeah, writers get attached to their characters.
Yeah.
maybe one, maybe all of them.
Yeah.
I have a feeling I know which character you were attached to, but I'll ask you first.
You will not believe who my favorite or the character that really was. And I always look forward to getting this character back onto the story because they were not always there. They were not always participating. But yeah. I loved Mr. Mark White. Right?
Oh, okay.
Yes. And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
I think somehow he represents the values I live by.
Yes, okay.
The values of being good to other people and creating opportunities for others. And so this was my guy. Although he plays not much of a big role, but he's my guy.
Yeah, no, I can totally get it. You know, you had a very beautiful way of weaving into what others would say is an interesting story. But you weaved into it some very important issues, you know, the politics, and other things. You spoke about values and other really important stories that need to be told or need to be explored or debated.
Yeah.
And how important was that for you to extract from what is a flowery story in a way, stuff that sometimes is uncomfortable to deal with, but has society needs to think or confront or at least discuss those issues?
So here's something. So there's a guy who always takes a taxi from Katlehong to Rosebank every morning to come to work, right? Mm. And he's got a very menial job. He probably, let's say he works for a car dealership and he washes the cars after, you know, after stuff has been done on those cars. But that guy in that taxi, when he gets in, he's listening to the radio and this current affairs. And then, you know, this fun, you know, T-Boys comes in, plays music and he's making lots of noise and stuff like that. He gets into the office. There are issues about so many things. He gets back onto this taxi. He rushes home because he's going to see his daughter and his wife, and there are issues about that. You know, at night he chills and then he listens to you and you're going running on about all sorts of things, including legal issues that, you know. So I'm saying we are complete people.
Yes.
We are not one-sided.
Absolutely.
And that's not only us who think that we are sophisticated. Every single human being is not one-dimensional. So the fact that I wrote fiction does not mean I could not deal with issues.
Of course.
And some of those issues are very close to me. And they had to come out, you know, in the work of fiction, but of course they're real issues. I mean, my publisher was completely fascinated about how I dealt with postnatal stress in the book.
Yes. There are many things that you deal with that I think you were very elegant about. And some of them were, I could tell this is definitely a black South African dealing with these issues. The driver, is it Chris?
His name Chris. Chris.
I just knew there's a nuance there. Yeah. That, you know, only a black man can see a guy that way.
Yeah.
You know, you saw him.
Yeah.
And you could see yourself in him. You
and know, Chris rewarded Morati for being seen, right?
Absolutely. Yes. And there are those little wonderful nuances. And yes, was your publisher white?
White female, right? And I was surprised that she touched this book because mainstream publishers turned down the manuscript again and again and again.
Really?
And Melinda Ferguson.
Oh, yes, it's Melinda, yes. Okay.
God bless her.
Oh, she would have.
She receives this manuscript. She tells me she's going on holiday. She won't touch my book for weeks because she needs a rest. She's just going through hell because of the AKA book she wrote. Lo and behold, 8 days later, she calls me to say, I have done nothing but read your manuscript and I think we've got a book.
Yeah, yeah. But she's open-minded that way. She's open.
Rather radical.
Yeah, no, she is. Are you the kind of writer where stuff just came or did you work hard at the story?
I don't want it to sound easy. And before I answer that question, so then I tell a group of friends about this book and I, you know, issue copies out. And this one friend, and I hope they're not listening, says, well done, Rems, even though it's fiction. And I felt slightly sorry for him because he doesn't understand that actually it's harder than non-fiction.
It actually is.
I had to create a story.
Harder.
I mean, if I had to do anything else, I just have to research and write it, right? Mm-hmm. This one I had to create.
Yeah.
So I don't want it to sound too easy. I don't want people to take a chance. But writing comes very easy to me. Once I've conceived it, to put it down on paper is the easiest thing to do.
You had to be brave to write this though.
Maybe crazy. I'm not too sure about brave. I've always been. People have known me for bravery, but I think this one is an element of being cuckoo. Right? But we had to go there. Here we are. Do you know that you have never, ever consumed any work of erotica where blacks are the main players?
No, I read all the time. I've consumed.
Zero, right? We are only in where the line is crossed. We then play, but even then we are objects. That's pornography. But in erotica, we don't exist. We may be the porter. We may be the...
I will share some books with you.
Okay.
Some really nice
I can't
books.
Wait.
Some really nice books, yeah. I
Please.
Will share some really... Maybe one really interesting author right now, South African, who's writing beautiful writing.
I can't
and,
wait.
Has a little bit of that, but very classy and very elegant. Actually, I thought of you. I thought of him when I was reading your book.
Okay.
But okay. You'd like it.
Okay. Why don't we give him a pound? Who's this?
You like it. Let me share the book with you, and then we can talk about
okay.
the book next.
Okay, great. Right?
So I'm going to have to take a break because it's one of those... Yeah, my producer is already yelling. Rams is in studio with me. The book is called The Sweetest Taboo, and it is sweet. It's sweet, and it's such a joy because, as I said, I mean, I didn't expect you to be writing a novel, but here we are, and it was, yeah, I couldn't put it down.
Thank you.
I couldn't put it down. And then this is Point of View. As we start now, we delve deeper into our conversation with Rems Mabote. So this is obviously his music choice. I'll keep my light in my window. Temptations.
This is a very deep song, you know. It's an exceptionally deep song because we associate the Temptations and all those groups with, you know, romance and love.
Yeah.
And here's a song about doing good.
Mm.
You know, I mean, this guy says, or these guys say, till love and mercy spread throughout the world, I'll keep my light in my window. And it's part of my motivation in life that every single day I'll try to do good. Every single day, you know, I try to find something, whether it's giving food to somebody standing by the roadside or advising a young person who needs some help, or because I think we are called upon this earth to do that.
Do you have a threshold? Do you tire?
I do. I do. And I was hoping to put this in a book so that then it's a fictional character who says it, nobody can blame me for it. I tend to be, and I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry if you're going to shoot me. I'm sorry. I tend to be not so sympathetic with the male street beggar than I am with the female one.
Interesting.
Because I think the circumstances that led them there are most likely to be different. Men take shortcuts, we quit very easily, and then things go wrong, and then we think the world must sympathize with us. Whereas 9 out of 10 times, she was left by a guy who tells Obuya he didn't come back. She's now left with these kids, and she's battling. And then that's part one. Part two is that when I give him money, he's most likely, I'm not saying all of them, going to buy alcohol or some stuff, right? She's most likely going to buy food for children. So I tend to think when I give to her, I'm giving to her children too.
So how do you...
So my threshold is men.
How do you feel about those who come with the children to the street?
No woman would want to do that. No woman would want to do that to their child. They do it because they're desperate. They don't know who to leave them with because I'm going to rape her when she leaves the child with me, right? We do that. We rape two-year-olds. No woman wants to do this, but she's got no place to run to. Yes, I'm sure there's one or two out of every 3 million who are wayward. But I think the majority of these women, if they had a choice, they would get even the worst of jobs and take care of their children.
How do you feel about white beggars?
Ask me the next question.
They're there,
yeah. I still worry about the majority of black beggars. My lens still says that there's much more of the people who are left behind. I just finished reading a manuscript, privileged to read somebody's manuscript, about how the English, the Jewish and the Africans mm-hmm. build their wealth. Mm. And he actually starts speaking about the white poor in that book. And he says, and as a result of what these tribes did, that is why there is still a scarcity of the white poor. Mm. So I don't think about much of them because they represent a minuscule of real society out there. Mm. Yeah.
So when did you hear the song for the first time?
Wow.
Because it must have made an impression at the time.
Now, I'm going to confess, when I first heard it, I was just dancing. I was not listening to this song, right? Oh, you know, everyone was dancing, having fun. I probably even tried to kiss somebody while listening to it. But, you know, there came a point in my life when I listened to this song and I thought, this is a great song. And it has become my anthem. It has become my song. It has become my motivator, my reminder that the world can get better if you and I do just one thing better.
How much does life and music in your life play? Does music, let me say it this way, how much of the music, a sample of what you're giving us now, plays into your daily life, not just life in general?
I think my children will tell you that if there's one part they probably do not appreciate about me is that I switch off from them and listen to music. When I'm into my music, I'm okay. Like, you know, like could bicker and worry about other stuff, or ask me to take them on a long bloody drop-off trip. Fine, sit there and I just play my music. Music is such an important part of me. And it goes back, I swear, it goes back to nursery school. I sometimes find myself singing nursery rhymes and think of Susan. I remember Susan at nursery school. Lehebi. Those two girls, I remember them. Go crash. It's in nursery school. Go crash. So music has always been part of my life. I remember how as a teenager in the student movement, I tend to think that I found more meaning when we sang. I saw our struggles more when we sang about these things, and I got tied up to this music. Then at 14, I met this old man who introduced me to jazz at bloody 14. But I truly started to appreciate it at 18, and I got married to it. And then, I mean, you guys could not get Master KG. I mean, I listen to everything, right? I ask for Master KG, Wire, right? I mean, I listen to everything. Music, for me, is not. Yeah.
Was there ever a time when the music stopped playing in your life?
No. So, well, maybe for 3 days. Maybe for 3 days. In 1985. So, in 1985, I get detained. You know, there was this detention without trial thingy that these guys had fun with, just taking us and throwing us into any prison they liked. So the first 3 days we spent in prison, we were all in solitary confinement. And I think that's the only time I ever spent when there was no music in my life. Because as we got out to go to the communal cells, we were singing every day back to the struggle songs, right? So those 3 days were silent and scary.
And what was that like, the solitary confinement?
I was scared. I was scared because at that time I had already read about people who died in prison, and I thought, why would they keep us alone? Are they planning to kill us? Didn't help that when they arrested me, they had bludgeoned me badly. I was badly beaten. In fact, I was so injured that some people told my parents that he should be dead wherever he is, those who saw the assault by the SADF at the time, who then handed me over to the SAPS, who then handed me over to correctional services. It was scary that Only the solitary confinement, I was scared that they could be killing us here. But once we got out of there and went to the communal cells, I knew that back to normal.
Was the scariest moment being caught or being in the solitary confinement?
Solitary confinement. Mm. Being caught, we got caught all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, we actually sometimes, I think, looked down upon those who were not caught. Like, why are you not getting caught? Right? Mm. So not so much of a big deal. We had heard a lot of people who came in and out of jail. It was okay. Mm. But I was scared by solitary confinement. I really was. And then we added to our own misery for the right reason. So in those 3 days, we also boycotted food.
In your state?
Yes.
How did you know what time it was?
No, I didn't know the time. I knew it was day or night. That's all. It's a small window. You could see the light is up, and that's about it.
I hear many, many who've been in that situation are preoccupied with that. They wonder, what time is it? You know, where are we? Because you don't get any feedback from anybody.
But they would still get the normal prison treatment of getting food, and food comes at a particular time and stuff like that. But because we had said no to food, they were not even bringing the food. So I had no clue. I knew it was daytime, and I knew it was nighttime. You know, and that's it. I mean, everything's in that room.
Have you, like many South Africans, have you shelved that part of your life experience somewhere very far away? Do you revisit it regularly?
Nah, I think it's shelved away.
Right. Why does that happen? I say that because I hear many, many people who've had those experiences. They don't talk about it. They don't talk about it to their families. They don't revisit it. Why is that the case?
I don't want to sound like it's a big nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. But I also don't want to be held back by that.
Mm.
No, truth is, it was 3 days of a 14-day detention. I mean, I had other detention, but this one was particular.
Mm.
But two, I don't want to play victim. I triumphed over this system.
Mm.
I was 15 when I was arrested at that time. Right. So a lot of my peers who got arrested or who were in the struggle never survived.
Mm.
People got destroyed.
Mm.
Not only did I survive, I ridiculed this system. I still passed. I still went to study. I triumphed over this thing. So I look at what I've achieved more than that period where they tried to destroy me and many others. I mean, I'm just one of millions who were in trouble.
All right. So Sibongile Khumalo needs no introduction.
None whatsoever.
Yeah.
But let me tell you why this song in particular. I mean, despite the fact that there's nothing that Sibongile could do wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But this song is one of two songs that stand out for me that were originally done as instrumental songs. And some other musician came to put lyrics into the song and reinterpret the song. So the first one was Take Five, Dave Brubeck, and then Al Jarreau came and put words into Take Five. Sibongile did this to Moses Mulelekwa's song and made magic out of this song. I was hoping for the Live at the Market Theatre version, because in that version I then get to enjoy the love making between her and Themba Mkhize on piano in that song. It's just, but he's still even on this version, but what they do on the live version is just, it blows you out.
So how do you reflect on her life and her contribution musically?
You know, one of the reasons I'm obsessed with Hugh Masekela, as opposed to many other people we've seen, all other artists, whether they're musicians or actors or writers, is that he never overrated modesty.
Mm.
We damn overrate modesty. And Sibongile was one of those people. She was a genius, born into a family of music, married into a family of music, trained classically as a musician. And she didn't tell the world, but I'm Sibongile Khumalo.
No, she didn't.
Like, she didn't do that. And it's great to be humble, but not great to be modest. I think there's a difference, and people must understand the two.
Mm.
And Hugh was never modest. Hugh was like,
he was never.
I'm Hugh Masekela, for crying out loud.
He was definitely.
He once stopped playing at the Market Theatre and said, "I can't hear myself think." You know? So I sometimes miss that about great people. And that's why, you know, we look around. The Americans don't downplay themselves. Mm. And we end up eating everything they feed mm-hmm. on us because they don't play small. Mm-hmm. I wish Bongde could have reminded us from time to time because she didn't know, as we didn't know, that one day she'd leave us that soon.
I suppose.
Yeah.
So you said you're writing again.
I am. I am, and fortunately this time the book is set in South Africa, mm-hmm. in Durban in particular. Mm-hmm. And it's 2019.
This is very recent.
Yes, yes, yes. And of course, the politics of 2019 will sneak in, mm-hmm. but it's still erotica.
Really?
Yes, I am going to be the king of erotica.
Really?
Yes. Somebody must do it. You know, Stephen King did his thing. Everybody does this. I mean, I gotta do this.
Yeah.
And I'm doing it because I found that as I was writing it, I must say, I kept on saying, damn, this is good. Even I thought, I'm doing this well. So why not continue, right? I will wait for a moment where I put out a book and I get 2 sales. Then I'll get the message.
Did you feel a sense of freedom writing this?
Excitement more than freedom.
Really?
Excitement. I even found that I'm trained as a journalist, right? Mm. There are 2 things you are taught, and they don't work for novelists. Mm. You are taught to be brief mm-hmm. and never, ever to use big words because you must write for somebody with a grade 8 education. Mm. And I found that for the first time, I could use words that were always in the bank that I could never, ever use as a journalist. And I could, like, this time, I'm just going to throw it in there. And if you don't know it, look it up. But this is what it is. So I was so, I found so much excitement and freedom. Freedom to be who I think I always was, and I was never allowed because the world wanted me to be this serious guy. And I played to it for so long.
I got that sense.
Yeah.
I got the sense that this is you fully being creative, fully immersing yourself in, you are being free, and you are being expressive, and no limitations, just
none whatsoever. I mean, so I had 2 friends of mine as readers of the book, mm-hmm. right, and female. Mm. And it was important for me that they had to be female.
Okay.
Because I had to always remind myself that I am a man and I may have my biases.
Yes.
And I need somebody to say, you can't go that far, or you missed a point, or something like that.
And, interesting. And what was their response?
And their response was so gratifying because they kept on telling me how I was on track and how beautiful this was. And, and that for me was just amazing, hearing it from them. Mm. And I knew that when they had given me a yes, that it's going to be difficult for... I'm not saying I'm not going to get criticism. I already saw some posts on Facebook referring to stuff that I don't think I was writing about. But I thought with these 2 adult, intelligent, independent, smart women who I know can call me out on any day, with them saying you're on the right track, I knew that, damn, it's gonna be difficult for somebody to come to me and say, what crap is this?
Mm.
Yeah.
Did you know when to stop writing this book?
So, here's something that the good universe gave me. I finish every book in my head before I start writing it. So by the time I was writing the book, I knew where it's going to end. I didn't battle. I knew the end. Even this book I'm writing now, I know the end. It's done.
And your end has remained the end from the head to the paper.
Yep. That was it.
That's very good.
And you got to teach yourself to end, Because as writers, we get immersed in the story. We fall in love with ourselves. By the way, the book was 120,000 words long until one Melinda got in touch with this thing and slotted it to 69,000 words.
You'd have to.
Yeah, and she saved me from myself, you know, where you start over-describing a door. Like, you know, like really, who cares how many centimeters long and wide, right? But insofar as where it starts and where it ends, great. The problem with me was that I overrode because I thought, this is creative writing. Now, you can't write like a journalist. You must hang on, man. You know, you must get people involved and let them see that button on that shirt and understand that, you know, it was 3 cubic centimeters. Like, really?
Are these characters coming back?
None of them is coming back. So no sequel.
Is this it?
This is it. Gone. Everybody keeps on saying, but...
And in your head, it's done.
It's done.
It's done, it's finished, it's dusted.
It's gone. It's gone. That's it. I'm scared of sequels.
Because we wonder about them.
Yes.
You know how characters live on in your mind.
Yes.
I wonder where they are now. I
mean, the one guy who's going to be disappointed that these characters are gone has to be Pex, right? Pekan. Because now he's hoping... You know, to ride on this wave of his friends.
There are many stories.
He's going to be unhappy with me that this is it.
Yes.
But it has to be it. Sequels are dangerous.
Why?
Because they're hardly ever as strong as the original story.
It's tough to write.
And they sometimes get very contrived.
Yes.
And we got to be careful about them. I did not want to get into that trap. So I knew when I was done with this book, that was it.
I don't know how to feel about that.
I'm sorry.
I don't know. There are characters who I'm curious about still, you know.
So again, good buddy of mine who, like you, devoured this book within hours, said, but can't Gaby come to South Africa?
This is exactly
later?
What? I think all the men in this town are going to want to meet Gabby.
Guys, you gotta go to Australia and find her.
I think all the men in this town want to meet Gabby. Gosh, I wanted to meet Gabby. I wanted to meet Gabby because gosh, Gabby.
Amazing, right?
Yeah.
For a 22-year-old.
Absolutely, Gabby. But also quite a nice nuanced story. Human story.
Thank you.
Her story is interesting.
It's an amazing story, right?
Her story is...
An orphan.
Her story is
making
interesting.
An amazing person of herself going forward. Yeah.
We want to meet Gabby. We want to see Gabby. Did you meet Gabby when you were in Australia?
No. I was in Australia. I worked for UPSA at the time, but I was a guest of Rotary International.
Yes.
Like, if you know Rotary, I mean, there's nothing more... Straight jacketed.
Yes,
than
of course,
Rotary.
Of course, yes.
And that's what I was a guest of families, and I'm hoping none of them are listening now, but they were all elderly.
Mm.
So I was the youngest person in the room everywhere I went.
Mm.
Nothing happened there. The best that they could do for me to take me out for food and alcohol.
Yes.
You know, and that's it. I got to play golf, at least. I was always a golfer, so I've got to play golf there. And you know, there's no mention of golf in this book. If you wanted
there
to know.
There is no mention of golf.
Because it's not biographical. It's not about me.
Yes, there is no mention. No, look.
I mean, Moradi bloody loves cider. I'd rather die.
And cocktails.
I mean, like, really?
Yeah.
Can you imagine me?
Cocktails.
Colored drinks with straws on. I'm like, never.
Cocktails,
and umbrellas and stuff like that. Never.
Cocktails. I couldn't see you drinking cocktails.
No.
Yeah, there are other things about him that I thought, no, not. Even if I wanted to pin him on you, but... the cocktails. I'm not sure about the cocktails. Let's play some more music. Point of view, huh?
You.
Jimmy Luzu. All right, Jimmy Luzu and point of view. Why is it so significant for you?
Oh, just in honor of you. What are you asking
me? I walked right into that.
So, I walk into this job, gig, Metro FM. By the way, at Metro I got hired the day before I started.
Really?
Yes. Got a call from station manager, said, I've got a crisis, can you start tomorrow? So I walk in the next day, like, you know, meet the technical producer just minutes before I start and says, so what's going to be your signature tune? It's like, are you serious? Like, really? said, anything, you choose. He said, no, you choose yours. And instantly I said, Jimmy Lulu point of view. Mm. I've always been in love with Jimmy Lulu. More as a performer than as a recording artist. I saw him perform, what was that? Tabern House or something like that. But in downtown Johannesburg.
I see exactly where that is, yes.
God.
That fellow
is something else on stage. And since that day, which was in the 90s, I was a disciple of Jimmy Lulu. And to this day, including my children, I'm associated. When people hear Jimmy Lulu, they think of me. And if only they knew, when it came to guitar, I was more of a Sipho Kumete man than a Jimmy Lulu person. But I love Jimmy Lulu. I love the work he's done. And this became my signature. And people got to know me through this song. My children made me a plaque for Father's Day with our picture and the song that I was playing there was Point of View. So clearly I'm known. This song reminds people of me, which is very interesting. Jimmy Lulu owes me some money.
He does. What's your reason for getting up every day?
Wow. This is the first time ever in my life that I understand people who want questions up front. No. But I never thought about that. I always say to people, and I suspect that's what I'm saying to myself, that yesterday is gone. Today is just a rehearsal for tomorrow. So I always believe that I have a chance to start again or to do better than what I did yesterday. I have been in business for many, many years. And I have failed so many times. Three monumental falls, actually, that cost me lots and lots of money. In the interim, I at some point took a job. When I went to Australia, I had a job. I took a job because I was so broke. I applied for a job. I found a CV somewhere and got a job. As soon as I had paid everyone I owed money to, I quit. And that has been my mantra. I'm going to try again. I'm going to be better tomorrow. Whatever happened yesterday is gone. And I always wake up to do better than yesterday.
So what's the life lesson there for you?
Preferably don't fail, right? But we are going to fail. For me and for my children, I tell them, we don't quit. If you truly believe, you don't quit. I was not published by a lot of people there. I never quit. I even told all my friends, if need be, I will self-publish. We don't quit.
And was it important that somebody else published you this with this particular one, the first one, at least the first one? In other words, was the validation important?
I think so. I think as an author, you want somebody else to see
somebody else's eye.
The value in what you produce. Because again, who wouldn't believe in what they produced, right? I want to believe I produced something great. But until somebody, especially a publisher, who's seen millions of manuscripts, say, there's a book in here, then I know something's happening. Right? Then I felt,
I get the feeling you are going to be doing, as you do, many things, dabble in many things, but this is the one thing you're going to stay with. You're going to be a writer for a very long time.
Well, firstly, I hope I live for a very long time.
For as long as you live.
Yeah, I mean, but I mean, you know, Colonel Sanders, and I said, I'm hoping this is my Colonel Sanders moment.
Yeah.
That at the ripe age of 54 that I finally found.
I think so.
What I... One,
does it feel like that?
Yes, it does.
It does seem like that.
Yeah. Right. Somebody said to me, and if you do it well, you'll then get other people commissioning you to write this kind of stuff for them. So I hope so.
So you said earlier you should have started a long time ago.
Should have. I should have. However, there's no regret, right? In doing the things that I did. In being a political reporter, I got to meet amazing people are going to write amazing stories. I mean, I broke stories that made front pages, not only here, but in other parts of the world. I've done amazing things. So I don't regret the things I've gone through. And they form part of what I write about in my fiction. Yeah.
But there is something to be said about being able to do something well, which, yeah, fine, you can.
Yeah.
And finding yourself what may feel like your purpose or the thing that you were born to do. What's that feeling like?
Orgasmic.
Mm. Mm.
It is completely orgasmic. I mean, you then think, why didn't I do this all this time?
Yeah.
Like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Mm.
Because, again, I think, why else have I been consuming millions of books all this time? Actually, I was projecting.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to do what those guys were doing.
Write the book you want, yes, to read. We've got more of your music, but I think, no, we don't have a spot break. Let's continue with the music. All right. Sanko Mota. I sometimes, you know, you don't listen to music for a long time and you forget about these gems. What took you back to Sanko Mota?
First, let me tell a story. Yeah. 2007, Kaya FM, starting this feature where every Saturday they're going to be, you know, playing special music by a particular artist, mm-hmm, or particular group the whole day. So
yeah,
it's going to be. And then on that Saturday, it was going to be Sanko Mota. So we asked to suggest songs, and I suggest Monoana.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Nothing. And they don't feature it. and then they play the normal, not nonsense, but
yes,
Papa. Guys.
That's the song.
Guys, when these guys moved from being Uhuru to Sanko Mota, this was the song.
Was
the song that introduced Sanko Mota into our lives.
Mm.
But I suspect the compiler was too young, did not know what I was talking about. Nobody really cared. So this song for me is the signature tune of Sanko Mota.
Mm.
It's when they became Sanko Mota.
Mm.
And I like it also because it's not the voice of Tsepo Tsola.
Yes.
People,
yes,
do this thing, yeah, about Sanko, yeah, Mota and call it,
yeah,
not Tsepo.
Mm.
It really grinds me a bit, but I try not to be a grumpy old man.
Mm.
So I love this song for that reason only, that it was the signature tune to say, now we are here, Sanko Mota, from the previous Uhuru that was in Lesotho.
Mm.
Yeah.
Rams, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. You know, we've run out of time.
I know we have. I know we have, but thank you so much. I never thought 1.5 hours. What does she want?
Yeah.
I didn't realize, right?
So I'll say this to you. I have never seen you more alive. And I think it has a lot to do with this book. I think you have totally. So I thought when you started your podcast, I thought, ha, he stumbled onto himself. That's what I thought. But I think you've now really, really found yourself.
Thank you so much.
It's evident. It's evident in how, for me, how free you were in writing this book. I don't think I could tell that there were no boundaries, no limitations. You were just a bird, free and flying, and you were really flying. So congratulations, really, sincerely congratulations on this book. And I would say it also this. This is one of those times when I think the numbers wouldn't have to matter. How many people buy this book, I think, shouldn't matter.
One famous author once said, I write for myself.
Yes.
If one more person buys, it's a bonus.
And I got the sense with this book that it's that for you.
Yeah.
So congratulations and looking forward to more.
Thank you very much. Long may I live.
You will. Thanks, everybody. I'll be back not tomorrow, but on Monday at 8 o'clock.
If you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.